Welcome to QualityCast North, a podcast dedicated to showcasing healthcare quality improvement across northern British Columbia. Casting today from the traditional territories of the Kleklaytane and Tsintsiyan First Nations are your hosts.
I'm Cher Chewy.
And I'm Lee Cameron.
You're listening to QualityCast North. Welcome back, listeners. This week, our subject is a little different from usual. Now, today, we're talking about the medical needs of those in short-term police custody. People in custody commonly need medical care, but getting them that care can be a time-consuming and expensive affair involving police escorts, the local hospital emergency department. But what if we could provide the care these people in custody need without having to leave the police station? This is the groundbreaking quality improvement project of today's guest, Dr. Michelle Brousson, a family physician in North Vancouver. Welcome, Michelle. So glad you could join us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks for the invite.
So before we get into your project, I wonder whether you could tell us a little bit about your background, maybe a little bit about where you grew up and what your journey into medicine looked like.
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in Victoria. So I'm a Vancouver Island girl at heart. And my undergraduate was at UVic, and it was back in the day, it was called human performance. Now it would be kinesiology. Mm-hmm. And so I actually looked at medicine from the lens of sports medicine. I thought I was going to do sports medicine. And then I did medical school at McGill in Montreal and just really fell in love with family medicine. Had a great preceptor in a rural area and realized how interesting family medicine was. And so that's how I ended up there. Most of my practice has been in Vancouver and North Vancouver. I have done some work in the north. I've done locums in northern BC and in Iqaluit and Nunavut. But otherwise, most of my work has been here on the North Shore.
So you've actually worked at a number of places and actually got to experience a lot of different cities and communities. That's great diversity, actually.
It's fantastic the way we're able to do that in medicine, and just exposes you to so many interesting places and people, and really appreciated being able to do that.
That's right. And broadens your experience, no doubt.
Right.
Okay. Well, tell us a little bit about your place of work, your clinic, and the team of people you work with.
Sure. So I work at a clinic called Health Connection Clinic, quite close to Lionsgate Hospital. It's within Vancouver Coastal Health. And I've been there since it opened about 12 years ago. And it was started initially because we realized our complex population on the North Shore, so those that are marginalized, that have particularly difficult psychosocial barriers, don't easily attach to a regular family practice, whether that's mental health or substance use or just the complexity of their medical care. And so that was the reason that we started Health Connection about 12 years ago. And it's just grown steadily since that time. It's team-based care. And so I work with, we have social workers, we have nurses, chronic disease nurses, addiction nurses, we have family doctors, and we have nurse practitioners, and we have our clinical support workers. And then we work with outreach workers who go into the community and help us connect with individuals that might be hard to reach or unhoused. So we have quite a good, and we're not a large group, but we're a diverse team.
Mm-hmm. And so that's interesting. And that feeds nicely into this quality improvement work that you've been doing right, along that same vein. So let's talk about that now. Your quality improvement project involves those in short-term police custody. So what was the initial problem that you discovered there, and what was the impact of this problem on those in custody and on the local police and on the broader medical system at large?
Okay, we'll have to unpack that. You'll probably have to remind me of the second part of that question. So this started initially from a community committee that we began during COVID. Our North Shore Family Practice Division recognized that we had the toxic drug crises and we weren't addressing that. So we started a stakeholders committee within the community. And it was through that talking to police and our outreach workers, that I first came to understand that there was a gap in care. And the police identified that when somebody came into short-term custody, on the North Shore, we have two different places they could go. They could go to North Van RCMP cells, or they could go to West Van Police Department cells, which is a municipal police department. And if they're held there, they, particularly during COVID, actually, it may take a little while before they can go in front of a judge. So they might be in 1, 2, or even 3 days if it was a long weekend, for example. And if this was somebody that was using illicit fentanyl or on opioids of some description, then it was only a matter of time before they go into withdrawal. And this is an awful experience for them. We had heard about other jurisdictions, for example, Timmins, Ontario, that were bringing Suboxone into short-term custody so that these people, when they're held there and they're detained, they don't also have to be miserable and go through withdrawal. So that's how it started.
So that particular problem, that gap in care that you identified, what's the impact of that on the police themselves, on those who have the person in their custody?
Okay, yeah, such a great question. When we first started this project, we really focused on the care of the detainee. And that became obvious how they would benefit. They wouldn't have to go into withdrawal. They'd be safer when they were released because we would bring down their chance of an overdose, for example. So we really thought we understood it from the detainee's perspective over time. But what I learned while doing the project over the last couple of years working with police is how it was beneficial for them. So for example, if somebody's in withdrawal, they have all the symptoms of a bad flu, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and that's exposure to biohazards for police potentially that they don't need to or want to be exposed to. Other symptoms of withdrawal are agitation, anxiety, irritability, and so, feeling hot and sweaty and shaking and shivering. And so those symptoms also made it more difficult for the police. It made their daily job much more complicated and higher risk when somebody was at their worst, as opposed to just feeling normal. The other thing that police pointed out to me, which I thought was really interesting, is if a detainee is going to be going in front of a judge or in front of Crown or talking to legal counsel, it goes much worse for them if they're feeling terribly than if they're in a good frame of mind. And as one sergeant said to me, they can literally remand themselves. They're so sick. They're not following the process and they'll end up staying in custody longer because they either were unable to cooperate or said the wrong thing or just couldn't pay attention or any number of reasons because they were just so miserable. So their ability to have a fair crack in the judicial system goes better and is better when they are more comfortable. So there was that piece. And then the other thing I learned from the police is when they release somebody who's in withdrawal back into the community, for example, they're at higher risk of going and repeating another crime because they still need to get their hit and they don't probably have any cash on them. And they've literally seen them go and then come out of the courtroom and try to steal a bait bike, for example. So they felt that it would help in those sorts of areas and that's what they were seeing.
Those are important insights, actually. And then the impact on the broader medical system as a whole, because it's not just the police and the when somebody needs urgent medical care, it's not just the person in the cells and the police that's involved. Often there's a visit to the emergency department as well, which brings other people in, right, at that point.
Exactly. So the traditional model would be the detainee would stay in cells and either tough it out, or if it became more of a medical presentation, then either the paramedics would be called to, in the case of West Van, the paramedics would be called. The paramedics would make a decision about if this person needed to be transferred to Lionsgate Hospital Emergency Department. Or in the case of North Van RCMP, they're right across the street from the hospital. So then a couple of sergeants would walk the individual over to the emergency department. But then they have to stay there. So now they're in a busy, overcrowded emergency department, 4 hours, 5 hours, however long it takes, with one or two police officers pulled out of service for the day until that individual can see the emergency room doctor and get possibly all they need is a methadone prescription, get it delivered to the pharmacy, pick it up, and go back to cells. So it also was burdening the emergency rooms, in which we know how stressed those are these days in the province.
That's right. And that's a big problem that we have in any case, despite these extra burdens that are being placed on them.
Then they would go to the emergency room for each day that they were in cells. So they might make two or three visits to the emergency department for a prescription, for example. So it just didn't seem to make sense from a, you know, using our services properly.
Yeah, that eats a lot of resource, for sure. Okay, so you identified this gap. Take us through the project now. And how did you seek to address this gap in care, and how did you get set about it? There are many, many logistical barriers that have to be overcome to do this, I would have thought. How did you seek to address the problem, and what hurdles did you come across?
Yeah, so we started by trying to connect with groups of people in police, trying to find pharmacy champions that would be comfortable doing this work. And then one of the biggest challenges was then a call group of physicians that would be available, addiction physicians or family doctors with addictions or capability to meet the need. And we started by talking to management at North Van RCMP and West Van PD, and slowly kind of made our way in, tried to understand this system from their perspective. So how does it work when someone actually comes into cells? And what do the mechanics look like of that? And then we put together an education package, and we did education sessions for the police officers as well as the cell guards. And we're now in our second year of doing the education piece. So last year we did, I think we had over 120 police officers and cell guards that attended a session. And it was just to provide the education around what is the medical understanding of addiction and opioid use disorder? And what is withdrawal? What does it look like? And that understanding that most people don't go looking for a life of addiction. You know, it's not a lifestyle choice, for example. We talked about the medication and the safety of the medication and how it works and the benefits of it. So basically, we started with just building those relationships, finding the champions in the various areas, and then bringing in some education and finding out how it is from their perspective. What did they need for it to be helpful and workable?
I'm just intrigued.
This is great work, isn't it?
And what an amazing example of capturing that multi-perspective in a complex situation, right? Like, you know, starting off with the detainees and then moving on with the police and community and the number of other folks you mentioned, and the engagement piece, that true connection, building that relationship. It's wonderful to listen to. But what were some of the most challenging parts of the project? You've alluded to several of them, actually. How did you move around to solve this? How did you navigate those particularly hard challenges?
One of the toughest challenges, and it's an ongoing challenge, is having a call group. And we looked at various different call groups. So who would be available to take the calls? And really, in the end, we just got lucky on that challenge, because as we were setting up and talking to different groups, we found out that the group Lighthouse, which is a virtual addiction service over the phone, was just starting up also. And they were interested in working with us. They understood what we were talking about and could see the benefit, because this is such a high-risk population for serious overdose. And so they began working with us pretty early on, but they're available sort of from 9 to 3:30, initially Monday to Friday, and now they've expanded another 7 days. But even still, I think they're down to one physician, I think. And so they're busy and it's tricky. And the other thing, of course, we learned from the police is a lot of these needs come after hours. Friday evening, Saturday evening, Sunday morning is when they need to talk to a medical team. And so for the time being, I cover those calls. So from 3:30 until about 10. 10 is when our pharmacies close. So there's no point in being available after that. But if they need access to medical care, I cover that. But obviously, that is not a long-term solution. And so that is the piece we're still working on, is even if we just had availability up until about 8 p.m., that would be, I think, very, very helpful. So that's probably been our biggest challenge and continues to be a big, big challenge.
I'm intrigued, actually, because one piece of this is it interests me, and that's the position on the from the police. The police are often, they like things done and in certain ways, and they get very used to working in certain ways, and they have their protocols and their policies, and they're not necessarily always open to changing those. And I'm just wondering whether you came across any issues along those, any resistance perhaps from the police themselves in this change in role, this change in their role for picking up perhaps the early signs of withdrawal. How did you find that?
Yeah, it took time. And I think initially there was some concern about taking on this project from a risk perspective. They were worried about, for example, bringing opioids into cells. Is that risky to be bringing those medications into cells? And are they responsible for what happens if something goes wrong with the medication? And so it was very helpful in that they explained their concerns, and it just took time, honestly. I think it was reframing it, explaining it that the risk is much greater if they don't do it than if they do it. Because if they release somebody in withdrawal and they immediately go and try and use from an unknown source, you know, after they've been off their regular supply for a little bit, they're high risk for an overdose. And so it's much safer actually to keep them on their prescription, whether it's Suboxone or methadone or Kadian, or to even use this as an opportunity to start them. Sort of a golden, you know, it's literally a captive audience. And so it's an opportunity to start somebody. So it was just working on the education piece, I think. And yes, I have come to realize it is very protocol driven, the way their jobs are done, for good reason, that, you know, their job is to keep us safe. And so they have to follow these protocols. And you know, they've definitely been very, very helpful and supportive of us at Health Connection. If we've ever needed them, they've been there and they've come right away. And so I very much appreciate what they have to offer. I also learned from them that when they learn the protocols, they don't always learn the why behind the protocol. And that was some of the feedback I got when we would do the education sessions, and then we'd have them fill out a questionnaire so we could understand what was landing and what wasn't. And that was some of the feedback we got, was that they often didn't learn about the why. And so just understanding that piece, I think, was helpful. And then just one or two champions willing to give it a try, because some of them were familiar with this. So for example, in Vancouver, in City Cells, they have a private service that is offered 24 hours a day. They have a nurse there. And so some officers already had seen this before and were comfortable and were willing to give it a go. And then once they did and they saw, this is really easy. This is This is very straightforward, not a difficult protocol to follow. It's streamlined, minimal questions, keep the paperwork to the minimum that we can. And then they saw how much better the evening went or the night went for the detainee, for the cell guards, for anybody else in the vicinity. Then it just started to make sense, I think. But that takes time.
Yeah, that's a really good insight into the process of change management, right? That the fact that you had a good relationship to begin with the police, and then you really took it upon yourself to consult them on their what they were concerned about, and then just take your time to work through those. I think that's an actually masterclass in change management, which is it's wonderful to hear.
Thank you. Well, I feel like we're still very much in the working through it process. It's ongoing, but this is the second year, and it's definitely easier. Absolutely.
That's good to hear. Now, how has the project fared so far? Have you been successful in meeting your goals?
Well, last year, so our goal was to build the project, I guess, and just see if we could make it work. And so we've technically met that goal. We have about somewhere between 2 to 2.5 calls a month, and that's gone up a little bit over time. And maybe that number will go up, or maybe it'll stay the same. I don't know. So every time someone goes through and we're called and the protocol is run, we try to then do exit questionnaires, either by a cell guard or by a police officer. And if we can grab that detainee before they leave, we try to get them to fill out a questionnaire as well. And the feedback we've had from that has been really good, that they found that it was straightforward. They found it helped them. It was beneficial to all parties. So we're seeing that benefit. We have not been able to show from the emergency room department, we have not been able to capture those numbers because those visits are coded in a way that we can't gather that information out. But one of the cell guards had the idea to look at the logbooks in the cells, and they were able to do that for us. And so in the logbook, all this I never knew. This is all, you know, so interesting and fascinating and a whole new world that I've learned about. So when somebody's in short-term custody, there's a logbook, and every 15 minutes, they have to check on the individual, make sure they're okay, and just jot a little note. And if they're ever transferred, so if EHS is called, paramedics, or the police take them to the hospital, that's jotted down as a medical incident. We don't know much more, but that's written in there. So we were able to go through the logbooks for the year before we started this, and then the year that we were doing it. It was actually 11 months. We did the 11 months before we got going, and then the 11 months while it was running. And we were able to see that in the 11 months prior, there was 41 of those medical calls. And while we were implementing it for the same period of time, there was 20 calls.
Wow.
So we can't say that that's causal. We don't know that, but we can certainly see a correlation. And we're curious to see what happens with the next year, if those numbers are maintained or what we see. So again, it was definitely a really good direction to see. So down by about half.
That is actually a big impact. A big impact on everyone in that situation, in that system. So, you're right, it's difficult. It's always difficult to sort of draw those parallels, that exact correlation. But I think it's got to have a major part. I mean, what else changed in that time, right?
Well, that's the thing. We don't know. And was there other change? Of course, it's not my wheelhouse, and it's working in someone's areas of expertise. But the management team that we've talked to, they found that very interesting. Maybe there was other changes that we don't know about that weren't captured, but we'll have to see. We'll see what happens, you know, next year.
Yeah, I think you should take the win. It's that's a great result. And just when you were implementing it, and as the project progressed, I would take the win. That sounds great. Okay. Well, I've got one more question for you about the project. It's this is you know your project is a really good example of addressing a complex problem, multiple stakeholders involved, both medical and non-medical, and so that makes your achievement even more worthy. But that complexity of multiple stakeholders, including non-medical stakeholders, is something that might actually put other groups off from wanting to implement something similar in the communities they live. And so I'm wondering if we had a community elsewhere in the province, for example, who maybe heard this podcast and said, well, actually, we would like to do something similar in our community. What key pieces of advice could you give them?
Well, the first thing I would say is please contact us. You know, contact me, contact the North Shore Family Practice Division because we're looking for partners. So shared care has given us another opportunity for 2 years to keep working on this and work on spread. And so we have one community that we're starting to talk to and we're looking for another. And so absolutely reach out. But just in general, I think it would be just talking to the individual parties. And so, for example, your local pharmacist, particularly if you have a pharmacist that does deliveries and delivers opioid medication, methadone, and Acadia Suboxone, they may already be going to cells on occasion and doing a delivery because they find out that that is where the individual is, and they may already be doing that. And even if they're not, they may know who those individuals are, or they may help connect you in other ways. Talking to the police officer themselves. And I really think it starts with understanding what's happening in your community. I had no idea. You know how that is. You don't see something, and then when you see it, then you can't unsee it. But I had no idea that this was a gap until just talking about it pointed it out. So I think it would be looking to see in your community, being curious if there is a gap there. Maybe someone's got something they figured out already, or maybe they haven't. And then talking to the stakeholders. And then I would say, I guess one of my learning has been really that you need to present the information in a way that matters to the listener. So, when talking about it, talk about how it's going to help them, how it's going to make their day better, whoever that person is, whether that's the police or the medical team or the detainee. So, you're not just presenting the same story every time, but you're presenting a tailored story about how this is going to be better in their day to day.
Yeah, that's great advice, and I think that's been the key, and I think the key to your approach, which has made it so successful, is that listening piece for sure.
You know, your project is undoubtedly pioneering work. And as we all know, improvement work like this can be hard. You know, you've spoken of the connections and the time and the engagements and from that what matters to you and just really being specific and targeted. What was your underlying motivation for the work like this and what keeps you going?
Well, I don't have a big background in QI, but I do like working at a systems level in some way or another. I found particularly working in mental health and substance use for the last dozen or so years and really sort of getting into that with the toxic drug crises, it can feel like a lot, and it's so hard to move the dial. And when you're in the kind of at that really base level on a one-to-one basis, you just wonder if anything's going to change, you know. And so being able to work at a systems level really inspires me and keeps me going and I guess energizes me because then you can see, oh no, there's opportunity here. We're going to find our way through this. It's just not going to come easily, but there's places that we can start working to improve things. And so that I find doing that kind of work really gives me that energy to then go and do the kind of that more in the trenches sort of work. And also I just think it's that common sense thing. It just when you see something that works for so many different people, it just makes sense. And so it's just hard to give up on something when you just feel like it should work somehow.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's a great answer. And, you know, it's great to hear how that purpose coming from systems thinking and through that quality improvement approach. And I can really sense that purpose and motivation coming through, actually, as you've been explaining the project to us, as well as your compassion for this community and the people you serve. And that's really, really come through today. So that's been great to hear. And it's been wonderful to hear about this amazing work and your success. So congratulations for that. And I know the work is ongoing, but I really do hope that you that this project spreads and spreads well across the province, because it really is worthwhile work for sure. So thank you for sharing with us, and thank you for coming on today. But unfortunately, we have to wrap things up. I can hear the closing music, which means that's all we have time for today. But as a token of our thanks, and as always, we'll be sending you one of our exclusive and highly coveted Quality Cast North coffee mugs. But until next time, it's goodbye from us. I'm Cher Chewy.
And I'm Lee Cameron.
And you've been listening to Quality Cast North. If you enjoyed today's episode, check out our other episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcasts, and subscribe to our channel. We'd love to hear from you. If you have a question for us about healthcare quality improvement, email us at qualitycomms@northernhealth.ca, and your question could feature on a future episode. QualityCast North is sponsored by the Physician Quality Improvement Initiative, or PQI. PQI is a flagship program of the Specialist Services Committee, a collaboration between the Provincial Ministry of Health and the Doctors of BC, with representation for the provincial health authorities. This episode was co-produced by Dr. Cher Chewy and Lee Cameron, with technical support from Levi Giles and Matt Walker of Expression North. Original music by Daniel Chewy. Further information about today's guest is available in our show notes on our website at nhpqi.ca.